Yeah, and we are live August 1st, 2022. About 10:20 a.m. Beautiful Monday morning, can't complain. Yeah, I didn't get caught up in any shelling. There's not like a live fire scenario here or anything like that. Situation is normal here in Serbia. Now, the headlines, of course, for those of you who have been following what I talk about, since the start of this conflict, I've said that the biggest spot that things would be likely to pop out of control if things were to expand from Ukraine, you know, would be the West Balkans. And the West Balkans is a real powder keg. And things pop off here. And not just randomly, but in direct connection to the larger parties to the conflict, you know, proxy or otherwise, happening in Ukraine. To provide a little context, just a little context, because we have covered this in past episodes. During the war, Yugoslavia, which is Serbia and Montenegro, during the war, they got a all right deal, and you know, halfway through, called the Dayton Accords, and this established the other little Serbia as an autonomous republic inside of Bosnia-Herzegovina. But it's fairly large, and it's about, you know, about half the size, and it has several million people. It's about half the size of Bosnia. I mean, it takes up half the size of Bosnia of the other, you know, so you have the Croat Muslim Federation. And actually, a few things have been boiling up over the past few days that are connected to this. And I don't know that people really caught, but, you know, obviously, Kosovo catches the headlines. But an equal area of potential destabilization is in Bosnia. And it's unlikely to have one crisis, and I think this point is critical, if you follow the patterns and stratagems employed by the cabal in the conflicts prior, they try to run multiple operations simultaneously. As an aside, we can note also that they tend to engage with plans and green light them and try to carry them out, execute them, even when the other contingent factors that those are supposed to build upon don't fall into place. Even if they don't. Even if it's known that they're not, even if you can observably see they're not falling into place, they tend to move the different contingent pieces anyway. There's a lot, and we've explained why. There's a lot of reasons for that. It makes sense. Not doing something has zero chance of success. Doing something has infinitely more chance of success than not doing it. Also, life lesson. Even a 1% chance is infinitely more than 0% of not doing it. So they tend to carry out these plans, even if there's a low chance, even if the other contingent plans are falling. What you would find, obviously, in a crisis in Kosovo, which is in southern Serbia, it's disputed with the rules-based system imposing contravening on the question of territorial integrity and establishing a unfortunate precedent, which now Russia has effectively used in other places. So, you know, with Kosovo, I don't know if people, you know, it's a very charged issue for people and it can be very divisive, but you're talking about a piece of land that you really start going back into deep questions that have been completely shaded by 19th century romanticism and later kind of linear or racial categorical haplogroup kind of attempts to categorize, you know, what makes a Serb, what makes an Albanian? Is it, you know, 20% Illyrian and, you know, people over at the Anthroscape forums, message boards, love to look at group pictures of people from the Balkans and be like, oh, look at this is a Pontid Arminoid. You know, this is a Dinaric. This is a blah, blah, blah. You know, Bulgar, semi-Asiatic, Turco-Bulgar, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, all of these countries in the region have steeped in their official history. You know, we've talked about facts, but this is a fact. Well, you talk about historical facts. So a lot of these conflicts appear to be charged by differences of historical facts, which, you know, number one, historical facts are not the same thing as empirical facts. Historical facts are what's been admitted to the record. Historical facts are more like legal facts. We have a problem in language. This is something I talk about, you know, besides larger, like larger crisis level questions of ontology itself. Like people don't know the difference between being existence and reality. And they try to define existence, you know, by defining reality and define reality by defining existence. Likewise with these other things. So you have to have a criteria for, you know, what's what. But in historical questions, you're going to have people are obviously prejudiced. People have skin in game. But there's a more recent history, and it depends how far back you look, but by the standards that kind of exist today, the modern day population overall in Kosovo are predominantly Albanian or Albanian, you know, derived. They're kind of unique. It's regionalism, obviously, and there's different Albanians. So, and Kosovo Albanians are different from other Albanians, and Albanians are different from each other, which is all fair and good. It's just a different thing. With the former Yugoslav people, the differences are primarily, you know, with the core groups, you have a religious difference revolving around the same language. Okay, so with Yugoslavia and Albania, obviously border each other, and they had a rivalry. As communist states, they were on different splits. As communist states, you know, neither of them were pro-Soviet. Albania went in a pro-China direction and kind of went in that interesting twist. I think it was one of the only countries to do that, you know, in what you could arguably call, you know, Europe, but, you know, in the Adriatic. Whereas Yugoslavia had its own thing. It was Marxism-Leninism, but it was really this different model, more influenced by organizational corporatism, and using more rhetoric of like self-management, like worker self-management, which kind of almost sounds like anarcho-syndicalist or something, or like a worker socialism or council communism or something. at the enterprise level, but it was, you know, more of a Western kind of orientation in the products and Yugoslav passport. So really you had almost like the European Khmer Rouge under Hoxha running around building bunkers. And then you had this kind of more cosmopolitan kind of westward oriented Marxist-Leninist state, supposedly, you know, Yugoslavia. They were both Marxist-Leninist, but like we said, one went in the Maoist direction, strangely, anti-revisionism. And then Yugoslavia kind of created its own thing. Intellectually, of course, the roots of Yugoslav Marxism are rooted in Austro-Marxism, which was always anti-Serbian, very interestingly. So even though, like, during the World War II and the partisans, you have the Serbs are very kind of connected to Russia, and even though there's anti-Bolshevik tendencies among the intellectual strata of the Kingdom of Serbia and a lot of the white and monarchist, you know, expatriates from the Russian Empire were living in Belgrade as a Kingdom of Yugoslavia, as a friendly monarchy to the Russian monarchy. But then, you know, with the conflict in the World War II with the partisans, even though you had a lot of Serbian partisans, the agreements that were made, you know, it's kind of like you had Yalta and all these conferences and how are we going to divide up post-World War II? And it was kind of like, all right, we're going to do Yugoslavia. It's going to be a socialist state. So it's going to seem like it's kind of part of this block end of things. But the political orientation is going to be very westward facing. And we're going to put the Croatians, you know, at the very top, and then have the Serbs be like the enforcers, like in the, you know, to dominate the federal intelligence services or something, and some of the police. But at the very top, we're going to have this Croat, and people didn't realize he's not even Croatian. We think it could be a Slovakian or Czech, you know, minority from Austria or Austro-Hungary or something like that, who was like a double triple agent. Just very bizarre stuff, by the way, with Tito. He didn't speak in Serbian Croatian. He spoke in a kind of a Slavonic for sure, you know, but it was full of these malapropisms that would be like if you weren't a native speaker or if you were an idiot. Very bizarre. But all of these seeds were laid in the destruction of Yugoslavia. There was never like a clear successor. There was never, you know, Lenin, you know, you had either it was going to be like Stalin or Trotsky, and it ended up being Stalin, right? And after Tito, there was no clear, you know, thing set up. And so there had been a meeting in the late 70s, the Club of Rome meeting that did, and the NATO and the Vatican, because they have to activate kind of like with the Ustasha, kind of those assets, you know, and activate the French, you know, legionary ultra-Catholic there's people who think that, you know, the Fatima thing means that, you know, Catholic countries are supposed to, you know, nuclear annihilate, you know, the world, so that, you know, on the ashes of the atomic fallout, you know, the czar or the, you know, patriarch of the Russian church, you know, accepts the Pope or something, whatever. It's like, oh, it was pretty fanatical stuff. And a lot of people, you know, recovering Catholics who want to maintain the tradition and want to restore the church end up getting caught up in this politics of, you know, Our Lady of Fatima, and, you know, just look at, was that person replaced? Like, look at the pictures of the actual, you know, woman who saw this apparition, and tell me if she's the same woman in later pictures, even, or what her real message was, and how was that message maybe hijacked, and what does the Bible say about seeing apparitions in the first place? Anyway, you could go on and on, but it's not, you know, I want Catholics just incidentally to do what they want in their life, and I want them to take control over the direction of you know, the present course of the church, and their desire to have a traditionalist, you know, angle on that is, I perfectly respect that. And I think there's more good in, than bad potential in that at this present time, you know, and it's good. I want them to succeed. Don't get me wrong. But a lot of that stuff, they get into the SSPX, which is fine in terms of like looking at internal church politics, but you can see the ugly head of NATO intelligence, Atlanticism, you know, within the Vatican dominating all these different branches, because they have the, just like the Democrats and Republicans, the Vatican has like its kind of its fake conservative side, and then it has like its, you know, liberal, open, you know, gay Muslims go to heaven alongside Catholics at the same time at a faster rate. So if you're Catholic, the best thing is to quit the church, become gay and something else, and go to heaven sooner, whatever the Pope was saying. I don't know what, you know, the formula he was kind of spelling. Well, those are just his personal opinions, you know. And that's why a lot of Catholics just kind of tune the Pope out. But what we're talking about is how, you know, at the Club of Rome, it was decided and how the Vatican was going to activate its assets. And, you know, the very interestingly, you know, because of the Nazi foundation of the post-World War II intelligence networks in Europe, out of the NATO intelligence, you know, being developed and raised out of Nazi intelligence, there have just strict kind of what we call a histamine reaction, like an allergic reaction to Orthodox Christianity. As people know, like Hitler's agreement with the Pope, one could argue, you know, obviously the Pope doesn't have a military, you know, what are they going to do? They have to agree, right? I guess so, all that, you know, that's fine, but he can be a lot of enthusiasm. It's all good. No, it's all good. There's no problem there. It's just, we have, in explaining the fanaticism and the networks of power, you know, and kind of the context of what the Albanians are in relation to that. So with Albanians, you have, you know, Islam, Catholicism, and Orthodoxy, and they're all Albanians. But then Albanians are divided a different way too. They're not just religiously divided, they're linguistically divided. They have two languages. And then they don't really identify. I mean, there's kind of like broadly, in the sense of like pan-Slavism or kind of like pan-Turkism or something. There's also people of Albanian descent who were Yugoslavian citizens in Kosovo. And those are also a different group of Albanians, very distinct, you know. Some Albanians think unrecognizably so from Albanians who themselves are all divided three ways this way and two ways that way in Albania, right? So that's very interesting social formation, and that's at odds with the Yugoslavian ones, based on the, you know, so-called Serbo-Croatian language, or the or generally the Stokavian prestige dialect, which is out of you know, Western Serbia, Central Eastern, you know, the Serbian part of Bosnia and the Dinaric Alps. You have Stokavian dialect as a prestige dialect, using, of course, like a lot of the language changes made in the 19th century, who was based on Croatian grammar adaptations or kind of heuristics that made the language a little less complex, a little less royal, a little less noble, but more cleaned up, you know, for translation and understanding, you know, maybe Slovenian or something like that. Which is all fair and good. That's just the history. And so you have, whereas Albanians are all Albanians, even though they speak two languages and then otherwise are divided three ways religiously, the Yugoslavians, it's like they all speak, except for, not, you know, the Macedonians can speak Serbian, and, you know, the Slovenians can speak Serbian. They don't teach it anymore. That's more recent. You know, kids can pretend not to, but adults tend to speak it or know it. But otherwise, it's Croatians are Catholic, Serbians are Orthodox, and Bosniaks are Muslim, and they all speak the same language. So that was a different basis for the formation of a state, much kind of more similar to the German basis for a state, because you have Lutherans and you have Catholics, and big regional differences and some linguistic dialects within the Germanies, but they still form a united Germany, right? So you get two-thirds through the 19th century and Germany is united, minus Austria, the smaller unification plan, I guess. So that was, you know, a very distinct path that these two places took. And then now with the populations in Kosovo, it had been, you know, you'd have to get into arguments over antiquity history, if that's even real, to look at Albanian claims to be the kind of the present incarnation of a prior existing, more like Illyrian people, or what were the, you know, how do the Greeks or the, you know, Macedonians of Alexander, those Hellenes, how did they interact with people that in that region at that time? What did they call them? Are those people there? It's kind of arguments. Did the Albanians arrive? Were they always there? It seems like they were there from antiquity. But does that mean that everyone, you know, all these problems with ethnicity and lineages and stuff, a lot of romantic idealism from the 19th century interferes with our understanding of really what happened. But you have this area of Kosovo called Kosovo. It's a region of Serbia that is one of the, you know, most important places in Serbian history, and was the foundation of one of the oldest Serbian states in medieval history. But Serbs have had, you know, different states, and the problem is, of course, in naming states after people and our Westphalian concepts of states and people. So it's not expected that states in the Balkans, which had been in the Byzantine system, you know, Roman system, and then the Ottoman system, but never the Westphalian system, we can make mistakes in terms of identifying the identity of certain states, or whether you want to call people Serbs or Croats or Bosnians in ancient history. It would be very similar, maybe, if you have, like, in modern-day Turkey, you know, referring to Lydian or, you know, Hellenic Anatolian things as Turkish because they're on the territory of Turkey today. You know, it's like, you know, Islam came to the Balkans much, much later in time relative to, you know, when these histories are being made. So, it gets all tied up with people's emotions. You know, at the end of the day, it gets all tied up with people's emotions. But you had states like Zeta. You had different... The problem is that you had Serbian states that don't call themselves Serbian, just like we don't do that. I mean, you have German states don't call themselves German. Sometimes they're, you know, Swabian or Bohemian or Prussian or whatever. So even though there was a principality of Serbia, it would be an error to think that's, you know, you would want to look at the ethnicity of the ruling class, you know, in terms of the character of the state. After all, you know, we call the whole country of Bulgaria after the ethnicity of the ruling class who came, you know, the Volga-Bulgars who came kind of like a Turco-Slavic people migrating into the, around the Black Sea, basically, circumference south into the East Balkans. So you have a lot of weird, you know, different stories, origin stories of these people that make up the Balkans. And that leads to, you know, nothing in and of itself, but great powers like to use soft power and like to, you know, try to infiltrate educational systems and infiltrate and get people hyped up on kind of black and white versions of history. And it's always amazing that everybody won the lottery in terms of who's right. Like if you're Albanian and you're born, hey, wow, you're right, you know? And if you're Serbian, you know, and you're born into Serbia and you're raised on the Serbian story, wow, you're right. Like what a coincidence. Like, but of course a people needs that version. You imagine a people going around saying we're wrong. That would be like Germans today, right? Like how sad is that, right? So, you know, there's many open ways to look at it, right? And it's almost inevitable in that sense. But to that's just the natural historical stuff that gets exploited. The reality today is that it's been primarily the Soros and NATO Atlanticist NGOs that have been building up this case in Sarajevo and in Pristina, to create further chaos, and they would pop off at the same time. And so a little known story from the news the other day goes like this, if I can find it here. You have the Croatians were saying that they're not happy with what's happening with Sarajevo either. Okay, and in Bosnia, see, Bosnia is held together in a very, very strange way. Now, locate on your maps, Bosnia, it's not in the same direction as Kosovo, but this is all you can drive an hour from Belgrade. You can drive like 3 hours south, and you'd be basically four hours, and the roads are bad. I guess there's a new highway, probably faster, a couple hours south, you're already at the southern border. You drive an hour, 45 minutes from Belgrade to get to the Serbian part of Bosnia. You see, it's all very close. It's all very, very close in terms of theaters and military operations, and the connectedness of the plans as well, and the powers behind it. So Kosovo, what just happened, obviously, just so people know, is that there's just an agreement on what goods, and this, you have a Serbian minority has been there, is remnants of an original Serbian population. In truth, of course, you have people, and they're born into a family, and they marry into another one, they change their last name. There's probably Albanians that have become Serbs, and there's Serbs that have become Albanians over the centuries. That's just how it works in reality. People are more similar than not. It's interesting. In New York, you might end up at some kafana, and there's going to be Croats and Albanians and Serbs, and they're all getting along. When you're here, though, it's kind of like in the territory, then it's all, territorial. So, this is obviously with the crisis right now, there's always threats from the Albanian authority, which is not recognized, by the UN. They're not a real country by the standards of either international law or the rules-based order, just sort of a rules-based order still wants recognition at the level of the UN. They try to meld the concept of rules-based order with international law as much as possible. They're trying to impose one on the other. But recently, I think some countries changed their opinion, and so just under half of the General Assembly countries actually recognize Kosovo's independence, but it's not a country at the UN. Within Serbia's constitution, it's Kosovo's part of Serbia, and countries representing probably about 3/4 of the world's governments, whatever, to the extent that governments represent people, right? Lick my nuts, but to the extent that that's the case, governments representing about 2/3 of the world's population don't recognize Kosovo as its own country. It doesn't have. And there's just a bigger problem here, is what's a country? Because you can't have an artificial globalist imperialist network that artificially life support debt-driven existence on life support of these microstates, which by other natural occurring matrices would be absorbed as peripheral regions of larger regional hegemons, right? So this kind of life support artificial system of propping up kind of microstates is really to keep them from congealing together, to keep them artificially separated by foreign interests, right? And like the Serbs, love the Serbs, hate the Serbs, whatever you fucking think about the Serbs, there's no doubt that the Serbian state is the most independent state in all of Western Europe, Southern Europe, Central Europe, and all of arguably what you can consider Europe, okay? Serbia is the most independent. So people look at Hungary and they kind of confuse that a country that's already in NATO and already in the EU can have a leader saying we're not going to do these things that are, yeah, okay. But the truth is that Hungary is not leaving the EU, nor are they leaving NATO. So what's up with that? Serbia is not in either organization, and they're the only one that is in neither and whose government no one believes in the Atlanticist camp that the Serbian government is serious about joining the EU. Why? Well, no progress has been made in that direction. There is an agreement. It's 20 chapters. Each chapter takes 6 months to bargain. It's been more than a decade that Serbia said, hey, you know, we could do this EU thing. Public support has dropped to less than 30%. And of 20 chapters necessary to negotiate for to have tentative agreements and then to move to a accession agreement towards a TA, a final agreement, zero chapters have been concluded. So you can look at what people say and then look at what people do and then try to figure out what's really happening. There is that component of the crisis, but this is very real because the Croatians they're locked in. So what's interesting about Bosnia as a region is that all three of these peoples are kind of interpenetrated. All the kind of the three main Yugoslav people groups, because like, you know, the Macedonians and Slovenians were like definitely lesser populist, lesser industrial, peripheral to Yugoslavia. But you kind of have the Bosnia, Croatia, Serbia, right? That's like a very important core. Montenegro is always included with Serbia in that kind of, so it's Montenegro, you think Montenegro when you say Serbia. It's been artificially disconnected since 2008 or 7. There was a very kind of, one would say, a bullshit referendum that Montenegrins didn't even support or know what they were voting. Living in Belgrade, wanting to be, you know, it all together. No one believes how the election turned out. The population is like 200,000 people in Montenegro. Again, it's not a foundation to be a state. We talk about, you know, what are the real foundations to be a state and what do you need? What are your military potential is a direct outcome of, you know, your total GDP. Your total GDP is a total outcome of your per capita GDP multiplied out over your actual population size. The number of conflicts that you can manage, the type of conflict you can manage is almost your upward boundaries of what you can, you know, finance, afford, mobilize is predetermined like mathematically by those kind of hard set conditions. They're hard set at any given time. I mean, you obviously can change them over time, but at the moment you're facing the issue, that's a known quantity, right? At any given time. Serbia militarily doesn't want to join NATO, but nevertheless, and doesn't want to join the EU really, but nevertheless is constantly told by NATO that they're unhappy with Serbia's present military size, which on paper isn't that high. Now it's true that the population with military experience or who had been part of the, you know, kind of like the reserves training program at different times has kind of been more mandatory than others or preferential if you want a job in the state, something like this. A lot of people have military training. So, and then you have the Russian military intelligence base in near Niš in southern Serbia that is known on paper as like a emergency center. Like it's going to be flood response, but it can be other, you know, emergencies too. And we know that the Russian special forces had deployed from there to handle some things happening when there was a very big attempted, well, was part of the kind of crisis of the color revolution in Macedonia a couple of years ago. And there was actually, they activated kind of these KLA, Kosovar kind of liberation army type cells, except in, you know, I guess this would be now for Albanians, the Macedonia Liberation Army or the Greater Albania Liberation Army or whatever it would be. But all these players are already in the region, guys. This is not like, oh, you know, Russia's looking to get in there, NATO's looking to get in there. No, there's NATO has now, just kind of to understand, a base to justify or to have the situation in Kosovo. They have a base there, Camp Bondsteel, and they have the KFOR, Kosovar force, out of NATO, and many different soldiers, many different of the Western mercenaries fighting and dying in Ukraine had been stationed at different times in the Balkans, but there was never any fighting here. But their attitudes about, it's more ideological. They like when mercenaries have been in, they like when Western mercenaries have been in the Balkans, because even though it's not combat experience, there hasn't been, you know, live fire for a couple decades. Well, there's been some shootouts and stuff, I take that back, but there hasn't been, you know, like a war for a couple decades, but they kind of get all, you know, into the evil Russians story. I knew some American guys that were in the military at the time, and they deployed when the crisis hit, you know, when the U.S. created this crisis in with Belgrade and the bombing and the deploying the U.S. forces into the region. They were being told, oh, this is like a mission in Europe. And he's American. This guy was a black guy. And he was telling me, and his eyes got all big, and he's like, man, he's like, I'll tell you, Hakeem, a lot of black guys call me Hakeem. I'll tell you, Hakeem, blah, 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 blah. I said, wow. I said, this was Russia. So they told us it was Europe. We get there. It's like, this is, you know, they will row you. They will row you. Yes, they will row you. You are not in Europe anymore. This is, you know, culturally, it's, you know, something else. Yeah, it's kind of like Greece, kind of like Italy, kind of like Russia, kind of like Turkey, but it's the Balkans. Definitely not, you know, Germany or France. And it was like the Wild Wild West during this time. So, moving forward, you're going to find that the Croatians are unhappy. They're unhappy with the setup there because, you know, right or wrong, better or worse, the political situation of the Sarajevo government, okay, which is half of the land of Bosnia-Herzegovina. So you have the Banja Luka government is the Serbian authority, and then you have Sarajevo, which is the capital of the whole thing, you know, in terms of the UN seat, because the Serbs don't have a UN seat in this little tiny, you know, I mean, it's half of Bosnia, but it's an autonomous republic within Bosnia. But what they want to do, what Sarajevo wants to do, is change the constitution, okay? But they want to change the constitution in a way to make, like, this artificial support that the Muslim Brotherhood and the Bosniaks received in this Western thing. So within Atlanticism, there's different factions and they have their divisions. Even though there's a, you know, a more pro Anglo-Saxon wing of the Vatican, it's very dominant. There's a transatlantic wing of the Vatican. There's a European wing of the Vatican that's not purely transatlanticist, but it's also very Orientalist, or, you know, anti-Eastern. Orientalist meaning anti-Oriental, very anti-Eastern. But you have in the Vatican, you know, different power struggles and things like that. But with the English, they definitely more trust the Muslim forces. The English have more, you know, confidence in those networks, that the MI6 works through the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, all that Lawrence of Arabia type, all those assets. I mean, they have that in Bosnia also. And really what happened is, so that NATO intelligence got behind the Muslim story, right, in Bosnia Herzegovina, the also known as the Muslim Croat Federation. And prior to the Western powers kind of propping up the Bosniaks, the political leadership had been Croatian. The more competent, more rooted population, and rooted probably regionally, being Catholic on the Adriatic, and, you know, you have Italy right there, and a lot of reasons. And Croatia also has a state next to it. Like, Croatia has a state called Croatia that borders the Muslim Croat Federation. Whereas the Muslim, the Bosniaks, they don't have their own state, okay? And Lavrov refers to this as the question of state-forming people. Are you a state-forming people? Are you a, you know, historically, have your people, you know, by hook or by crook, formed state institutions that grow kind of organically and in a stable way, so not like superimposed, cut out, and then kind of kept alive through, like, you know, like a Frankenstein's monster that's kept alive through a what is it called, life support system. That's very different, right, than the states that grow more slowly over time and have organic institutions and more reliable customs and practices in terms of, you know, the succession of power, and what are the mores and the laws, and how do we do what's considered normal. This is all psychological in your mind, by the way, like, just like borders and laws, all these things exist in your mind. All these laws on books are just words that we've put, you know, they exist through intersubjective agreement. Those can land you in jail. It's very real, but nevertheless, they're fictional at the same time. I mean, there's a reality, but they don't exist. That's why it's important to differentiate reality, i.e. dynamic processes of the movie, from existence, i.e. the photograph, static, empirical reality, empirical existence, rather. Remember to not use the term to define the term. So the existence is obviously, existence is things, what, for example, that you can taste, see, smell, touch, right? It's the photograph, for example. The movie is sort of like the meaning, the dynamic. Picture of a guy falling is completely impressionistic. It's not a fact. There's no fact of falling. The facts are the person. The facts are the ground. The motion is a reality. That's the dynamic. It's also temporal. It's dynamic through time and motion. Very different reality from existence. But once we tackle those ontological questions, then we understand. You know, when we read articles in the news, we can tell the difference when they're lying, when they say. But that, and those just aren't the facts of the matter. And you're like, oh, what type of facts do they mean? Do they mean, you know, legal / historical facts, or do they mean empirical facts, like touch, taste, see, smell, right? Like, those are very different types of facts, aren't they? The facts of the case, Your Honor, have that stricken from the record? Well, you can't have reality stricken from the record, can you, right? And you can't have a judge decide that a fact is immaterial if it's an empirical fact, right? It's only, you know, judgment, questions of value judgments on the interpretation of dynamic instances, right? So, likewise, with the crisis now unfolding, yeah, this thing will definitely pop off, because, I mean, if that's the crazy place that they want to take things, because it will activate the Germans from their slumber. And I think if I swallowed the lead by talking about the history of this, excuse me, because the real problem is that Germany is far more invested in manipulating the outcome of events in Serbia than they have been paying attention, or obviously paying attention, but able to let's say maneuver or manipulate in Ukraine. But the Atlanticist side on the issue of Serbia, unfortunately, lines up with both German power interest groups. So whereas sanctions against Russia are opposed by German industrialists because they still have to make things, and even though they're loved by German financialists because of their drug problem, they're high on some concept of what money is. We'll just print more. I'll just cut Russia off and print more money. That'll solve it. It's like everyone's like, we know those are famous last words, guys. Like, oh, fucking wheelbarrows of money to buy a loaf of bread. We've been there. At least the Germans have. So where they will, but where the industrial interests align with Atlanticism for the Germans is in Serbia. The angle, of course, is how can Russia finalize deals with Germany about Yugoslavia, or rather Serbia, so that Serbia is used by German industrialists in its sale of items to the blockaded countries like Belarus and maybe Kazakhstan soon, hopefully, Russia. Germany has things to sell, and under the sanctions can't sell those things, but can sell to Serbia, and then Serbia can do some value, you know, what is it, value-added labor, kind of final production stuff, put some stamps on it, some final whatever things, they'll call it, they'll put Fabrika of Serbia on the thing, and then it's sold to Russia, a German item, as a, you know, final production Serbia. So Mercedes was talking about doing this when they thought, you see, people are getting ready for this back when the Crimea and then the war in the Donbas first started like 8 years ago. So this is not new stuff. Like, a lot of people have been preparing, but the issue of Serbia and Croatia, Bosnia, Kosovo, those regions, this is popping off. Now they will have, this is popping off if cooler heads don't prevail. They really want to push for this. I can tell you that for the 4 years of the Trump administration, there was a very strange cool in the West Balkans in the temperature of the political, you know, the political temperature was hella fucking cooled off. I don't know what exactly was going on. You can only kind of sort of like, we're poking around this elephant, we're seeing different parts of it. But in the Trump administration, there was just probably zero support for any of these, neocon, neoliberal, Clinton, Bolton type shenanigans. There was a lot of sense of safety, frankly, and normality in the Balkans. And if you read like Beltway publications like The Hill, they were constantly publishing op-eds from NATO colonels and generals about how Trump's policy on the West Balkans, which always means, you know, what Serbia is doing wrong, was bad because they weren't, you know, being, they weren't pursuing the anti-Serbian agenda of the prior, you know, Clinton, Obama, Bush, you know, the neocon, neoliberal agenda. Trump wasn't pursuing that. So whatever you think about Trump, about whatever other things, and I don't agree with Trump about, I think, you know, building a wall as a concept is kind of dumb, but when you kind of learn the details, you can see it's really about certain, not the whole wall, but certain areas that are actually very dangerous for the migrants. So it was very hard to sell the wall because it's not a total wall. Just for an example, if you're not American, to kind of understand Trump derangement syndrome, even though Trump had to pitch the wall to people that maybe have whatever their motivations are, and he couldn't really say, he did, by the way, but it wasn't really highlighted by media that coyotes are taking people in certain areas that are particularly bad deserts and stuff, And but those walls force people into areas to not take those risks on human life, right? Is the long and short of it. It's actually about the fact that like half of all women that are trying to cross the border illegally also wind up as victims of rape by who, you know, would be either coyotes or other, you know, people trying to cross into the country illegally, typically, right? Or people like coyotes and their friends taking advantage of those vulnerable people or human traffickers, etc. So there's a lot of weird stuff in the U.S. around that. But one of the things that we didn't have on the frontier in international affairs was a destabilization policy in the West Balkans. And even though the Biden administration has been really defanged by the Trump administration, even, you know, going into it in terms of what's possible, all of the Sorosian NGOs and the CIA can continue to operate in tandem, and they have they're freer to do that now with the Biden administration. So even though Biden administration, even though Biden is obviously doesn't know, you know, where he is, that he's alive or whatever, so there's other processes going on, it also changes that. And for things that happened from the previous administration that you can maybe call like sabotage, or you know, arranging things beforehand, Biden's hands are really tied in a lot of this stuff with Russia or with even with Latin America or with China. It's really tied. A lot of the Trump administration international affairs, or you know, their position on global matters, is more realistic in terms of this is the actual condition of the U.S. military. This is the actual response that countries are going to have. This is the actual, you know, reality. Trump had the ability to make something that we don't want, that something that we can't do, seem like something that we don't want to do because the other guys aren't doing their end of things. That's what the whole NATO thing was about. He just makes it sound like, well, you know, we're very strong and we're very wealthy and we're kind of being too generous with you. The point, really, that's not the reason. The reason is we can't afford to do NATO anymore. We need them to pay more. But then the question is, why, under what type of countries can build legitimacy off of paying, financing their own occupation? You know, was the question, you know, that the last emperor of China was appointed as, you know, the emperor of a Japanese occupied Manchukuo posed to the Japanese authorities, right? And the Japanese authorities said, so now normal, who else is going to finance your occupation? You always finance your own occupation, motherfucker, fucking idiot. Yeah, you finance your own occupation. That's why we're here. You finance and then some, you know, like we're here for, you know, you finance the occupation and then, you know, we finance the cream on the top for ourselves. Like, that's the point of it, homie. Like, you know, what'd you think this was, right? A charity? So that's the situation now with Sarajevo. There's been a charity project for Muslim Brotherhood Salafist leadership through these MI5, MI6 Muslim Brotherhood organizations that are managed by the British Empire. And the Croats, you know, whether they're, you know, kind of more chill, or whether they're kind of more on the hardcore, you know, Catholic Ustasha, Pope Gregory kind of tip, SSPX militia kind of tip, all of them are unhappy with Bosnia. And, but, you know, there's a potential for them to try to make an agreement that so that the outcome is only directed against the Serbs. But the thing is that Croatia's involvement in Dayton, they have the foundation to cancel that. They can pull out of Dayton. Dayton is a good agreement for the Serbs compared to, you know, agreements that would have been possible after, you know, after the U.S. bombing. It's good that Dayton kind of got plugged in when it did. But Bosnia is really the one that's at risk of disintegrating. Okay. This region does that. And even though everyone's looking at Ukraine, okay, as you've been following, if you've been here with us, you know that the conflict simmering in the Balkans in Bosnia Herzegovina is huge. The first resistance against Nazi occupation in World War II, like where the kind of the chinks in the armor became really visible, not with the opposition from talking about the Soviet Red Army, but just from talking about resistance, like against the stormtroopers, you know, on the planets, right? Not the Soviet Union, but just the uprisings. That resistance began in Yugoslavia. And World War One, kind of those events with the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, you know, by the Black Hand group, Serbs, that is said to have triggered off the events that triggered off all the different, you know, alliance agreements that were preset, but triggered off execution of alliance agreements that made World War One inevitable. So this is, I mean, I guess people, you guys know that, but that's why you're here. So this is really the region where the craziness happens and to follow. So Bosnia is really the linchpin. See, the situation in Kosovo can be managed because the Albanian state has to operate through a few different proxy layers to operate in Kosovo. And really, it's a NATO effort. Okay, but the situation there, as much as it is disputed, the kinds of things that happen are basically quality of life disturbances, like a soft, sometimes hard kind of ethnic cleansing pressure against the Serbian enclaves in Kosovo, which they tolerate, but so long as those are tolerated, they won't necessitate a Serbian military response as such. Okay? But what has been established as triggering as much even a Russian response would be Sarajevo. And you were already seeing this happen. And, you know, just a few days ago, we said that the Croatians are upset. They also don't want, they're also mad. The Croatians are mad that, you know, they've had a lot of the Bosniaks. So people who are like kind of Western liberals and leftists probably have everything twisted in their mind. They think the Muslims are maybe the indigenous population, the Muslims are the oppressed ones, or what, you know. They might transpose their limited knowledge of the, you know, conflicts in the Middle East. And wrongly transpose them onto the West Balkans. Okay. Muslims in the West Balkans in Yugoslavia are the descendants of the imperialists, of the occupational ruling class of the Ottoman Empire. And the people were Serbs, or Serbian-speaking people in the region that, you know, had, there were some moments of breakaway religion, kind of like the Cathars, kind of like this type of thing, you know, quasi-Gnosticism. Very interesting, I think, theologically, and some very interesting debates that arose. But that's the issue of also being in a land contested between the Eastern and Western Roman Empire and, you know, the Eastern and Western churches, which even had the divisions before the divisions, right? You had divisions even in the 700s. So, with the, you know, the Bosnians, what we know moving forward is that there was a policy of the Turks, of the Ottomans, rather, of the Ottomans to create, they changed the model of the military away from the Gulam model, where for example, Serbs and Armenians and kind of Christians, Pontic Greeks and Christians of the Ottoman world would remain Christians and form, you know, Armenian or Serbian, you know, armies that were independent, you know, were uniformly, you know, Christian or uniformly Serbian or uniformly Armenian in the Ottoman Empire's armies. But then they changed that into the Janissary model, away from the Gulam model. And the Janissary model came with a uniform code of you have to convert to Islam. And that was the big difference between the Gulam over to the Janissary model. And Janissary were raised out of, you know, Serbs. Effectively, you would be out of, Croatian Bosnians and Serbian Bosnians, but there's no real... Bosnia is a region. There's not like a people, really, that you would call Bosnian, but there are traits of a people. There are traits, you know, that are more Bosnian than Serbian, but those would be shared between Bosnians who are Croatian and Serbian and even Bosniak. So again, all these kind of artificial divisions are bizarre in many ways, even though you can explain them, you know, very clearly, you know, how they wound up. One can't help but feeling there's some arbitrariness or a problem that needs to be solved here. Other people who made, you know, you have state forming people and then you have system forming states. Okay. So from the perspective of IR and even through historical and anthropological lens, the Serbs and Croats are state-forming people, okay? And that means that they have formed states historically and institutions behind those states that have relative degree of independence and stability. Whereas the Bosniaks are not state-forming people. I mean, they're the carryover of a local force that was conscripted in kind of a forced conversion to Islam, and then now they're just, you know, now it's all just regular people, many different walks of life, so they're not all soldiers now. Obviously you have lawyers and you know, farmers and butchers and, you know, candlestick makers, whatever, the butcher, the baker, candlestick maker, all of that in, you know, Bosniak society, obviously. But the Russian policy is not that they're recognized as being a state-forming people that's capable of creating a stable state, okay? And the Russian view is that the Atlanticists have propped up the MI, through the MI6 and through NATO intelligence, the Muslim Brotherhood connected political parties. Some seem more radical. There's like kind of two, and one's kind of seems more, you know, hardcore Salafist, and the other kind of seems more like light, you know. All of Muslim Brotherhood is the light version anyway, because they engage in parliamentary politics, kind of like the socialists, as opposed to the revolutionary communists. Like the socialists will, or the Euro communists, or the socialists will run in parliamentary elections as the socialist or the communist party. Well, now socialist means anything; it doesn't mean Marxist or anything anymore, right? But the communists kind of at least say it does, right? Socialist just means, it's like Mitterrand or anybody, right? It doesn't mean anything anymore, right? But with the communists, they definitely have a split. And likewise, the Salafists, you would say Salafists, you know, I mean, really the more bigger influence on Muslim Brotherhood, contemporary Muslim Brotherhood thinking going back to the 50s would be Khotob, right? Writings of Khotob and his cassette tapes or records. And the parliamentary approach has led to Sorosian institutions being used in Sarajevo to prop up, to make, you know, changes to the Bosniak culture that are very oriented towards the Gulf monarchies and very... You know, one thing about the if you didn't know that much, but you knew kind of like what, you know, maybe a Greek folkloric costumes look like or something like that, you know, if you had kind of traveled through the region just decades ago, you would just see that. And you wouldn't really know that one was an Orthodox or one was a Muslim. But there's been a trend being pushed by the Gulf monarchies and through the British intelligence to kind of Arabize Islam in the West Balkans. And you know, besides Arab being the, you know, poetic religious language of the Quran, and despite that, most religious Bosnians, and most were not religious, but most religious Bosnians can recite the Quran in Arabic. They might not be fluent in, you know, literary Arabic, but can recite the, or, you know, passages of the Quran. And but that's been being promoted more and more. And you know, the Al Jazeera has a outfit based in Bosnia, and so does I think so does BBC, or that might be the Al Jazeera, because kind of Al Jazeera took over BBC in some areas. Same thing though, same network. That's actually BBC being like MI6 and Al Jazeera being Muslim Brotherhood. There you go. That's like and BBC handed off its, you know, Arab network to be run directly by the Al Thani dynasty in Qatar, giving you Al Jazeera. So that network is trying to seize power in another stage. And these things happen in kind of stages. Like you saw, like in Ukraine, you had the 2004 unconstitutional kind of shenanigans that produced the first crisis. And then you had the 2014 coup. They moved, you know, the coup agenda moved forward. So these different, even these illegal seizures of power, or, you know, do-over elections and all kinds of games and election fraud and changing the outcomes of elections, creates these fractures in the state. But that doesn't mean that you're not going to have more fractures and more crises. Speaking to Americans about our last presidential election, it can fracture again. It can get a deeper crisis based on the next big outcome or two more outcomes. So between those 10 years, there was another big attempt. And likewise, in Sarajevo in 2014, there was already an attempt by the Muslim Brotherhood through their, you know, parliamentary parties in tandem with the fucking ETC, the European Trade Union Commission, or ETUC, ETUC, the European Trade Union Commission, of the fucking Yellow International, of the, you know, they're supposed to be members. A lot of the ETUC political parties are, it's just nonsense what it means, whatever the Second International means. The Second, you know, the Socialist International of the Second, you know, the Second International, the Communists are the Third International, the Socialists are the Second International, right? The Marxists and the Anarchists are the First International. The Second International is the Socialists. The Third International is the Communists that broke off from the Socialists, right? Zimmerwald Conference, Lenin, what was that, 1914 something, whatever, 15, whatever it was, 1912, forgive me. After Zimmerwald, you have the foundation for the Third International. Well, that was established after the Russian Revolution, right? And they appointed Zinoviev to head it up, right? But the Second International parties that are connected, that are the political parties in the countries that are, kind of represent the trade and labor unions and are members of the European Trade Union Commission, they got behind labor protests in Sarajevo that the left and the Western Atlanticist media reported were labor uprisings, as if you would think this is like some, like almost like classic old left, like worker mobilization against austerity. Turns out they're fighting for constitutional changes. Oh, what? Oh, well, to guarantee some rights for workers. Well, that's good. You think that's good, right? Or what are the other changes of the Constitution? Oh, to eliminate the veto over state policy, international policy and agreements, the veto that the Serbian Autonomous Republic has, that they have. And that same veto is what also the Croats at a different stage, at an earlier stage in decision making, they have a rotating, they have a very messed up situation. It's very like hard to get. It's a game, you know. It's like a board game that has all these weird rules. That's how like the parliamentary procedure game in the Sarajevo side, the Muslim Croat Federation, the Croats feel like they're getting the raw end of this deal. And despite that, that they are state-forming people. Now, you have state-forming people, and then you have system-forming states. And the Serbian power in the end of the 19th and early 20th century was regionally hegemonic enough that its monarchy decided to make a kind of integrated with the Croatian and make a kingdom of Yugoslavia, which was the territorial foundation of socialist Yugoslavia after World War II. But it was first a kingdom that was kind of came together as a united kingdom of the nobilities agreeing on a union, kind of like a union state, and then it's a, as a federal later, as afterwards in the socialist period, a federal state. And in the Kingdom of Yugoslavia represented Serbia kind of going in the direction, having successfully been a state-forming people, now going into being a system-forming state. In other words, other kind of states that are, let's say, proximate, bordering, regional, gravitate kind of towards this larger mass. The way that, like, you know, planets surround a sun, you get, or we talk about satellites, right? That's a satellite country. Well, satellites might be distant, but this, the gravity of a country that's gone from a state-forming people, now you have a system-forming state. So there's a system of other states, like you're talking about the Croatian state, the, you know, Bosnian, whatever that is, the Macedonian, whatever that is, the Slovenian state, all of these kind of around the gravitational pull of Belgrade, right? It takes foreign powers to kind of work against that, right? Like, think about how the British were involved in intrigues in Germany in the 1860s, 1870s, when Germany was starting to form as a country, to be like a single nation state. And how the English, because their monarchy is very tied up, they're actually an extension of the same lines that come out of the the same families that were established in the 11th century out of the Holy Roman Empire. And the English were involved in trying to frustrate negotiations and stoke fears among the different Junker nobles and the different, you know, princes and kings in Germany. And it didn't succeed. And Germany became a country despite, barely being held together by a language that has had very different dialects. Austrians still speak differently today because they weren't really united at the time. But there'd been efforts to kind of unify the German language, to create a German state, despite having Catholics and Lutherans and other Protestants and big ethnic, you know, historical differences and geographic and stuff. It didn't happen in Yugoslavia. And then there's a certain fatalism. There's a certain fatalism typical of Slavs. Whatever is the present situation is the fated one. Well, what happens if things change? Is that change fated also? Slavs can't answer those questions. I'm kidding. Slavs can't answer those questions. Everything's so fatalistic in the given moment. But then when things change, or the fact that things could change for the better, then was that fated too? And how do you know it's over? So we say it's not over till the fat lady sings. And the Serbs, you know, might say it's over, much before that. But those kind of that, so there's kind of this experiences what might lead to those opinions, for sure, to be discouraged. But a lot of the thinking is that Yugoslavia was, you know, destined to end. Well, you may sound, you know, awfully fucking smart saying that in the present moment. But the same forces that formed other countries and then, you know, larger regions or even civilizations went through the same process, which is not to say that you'll succeed at forming or reforming a system around your state. But they certainly gotten you to think that it's not even desirable. So yeah, the Western intelligence also worked on Serbs to identify Serbianness as inherently orthodox. And there isn't enough, there's not a sufficient Serbian identity that's not connected to the religious distinctions that otherwise leave you with a single people that speak a single language, that have religious divisions that have been exploited mostly to the benefit of foreign powers, to the detriment of any kind of regional forming into a system-forming state or a regional hegemon like it was. I mean, there was a time that Yugoslavia was considered the most powerful state of Europe economically, like in the 70s and 80s. So it's a, you know, it's a tragedy. But among the problems today and what you're going to want to be looking for, and I said this a long time ago, and I think I reiterated about 4 months ago, at the start of this conflict or more, maybe at the end of February, I said that you're going to see how they're going to do this is you're going to have femen, you're going to have like edgy, like lesbian hipsters with like, you know, manic panic purple armpit hair with, you know, I hate Putin or Vucic is a murderer, you know, written in black lipstick across their, you know, chicken chest, inverted nipples. And then they're going to also be wearing hijab. And they're going to be Muslim. These are empowered Muslim women against, you know, patriarchy, oppression, Islamophobia. There would have to be probably a mustachioed one, too. Or a trans. And that's what you're going to see in Sarajevo. So you're actually going to have these Muslim Brotherhood, you know, Salafi light parliamentary insurrectionists that want to change the constitution. It's going to create a crisis with Croatia. Maybe they can smooth that out, you know, in terms of the Croatian representation or a Croatian veto. But they really want to angle out the Serbs. And the Serbs have a different relationship with the Federation because the Serbs have an autonomous republic, whereas the Croats and the Muslims don't have their own little like autonomous within Bosnia. It's like a canton system, like the Swiss, and it's a checkerboard. And there's areas that kind of tend to be more one than the other, but they're interpenetrated people there in that region. They're interpenetrated, and interpenetrated people makes it difficult to unwind that, doesn't it? Without violating the individual rights. You can't talk about collective rights because then you talk about displacing people, population exchanges, then you're going to have later the right of return, like with the Palestinians. These all create massive, massive like potential crimes against humanity, even if the intentions are good. You never want to be moving around people. You never want to be proposing things like remove this people from this place. Like these are individuals that have housing value. These are the people's lives, like what they want to live there. And you can never change that. But even just economically, you can't force people to sell at a certain time, like that eminent domain stuff. And then they're not selling at optimal market. Like these are individual people, like their whole lives, mortgages wrapped up into this stuff. And what, because you're the wrong religion, because you're Orthodox or because you're Muslim, you have to move around, or Catholic, you have to move around these different fucking cantons. Like, no. So what these Wahhabis are going to be doing is creating exactly those type of crises. And they're going to try to create problem reaction solution, where other sides start coming up with, you know, pursuing these disastrous ends, right? Of population swaps or population removal. The way forward is going to be probably that Lavrov is going to reiterate what we've what we say here. This is a good place while you're here to know the things also that are going to be said. Lavrov is going to reiterate, okay, that it supports Belgrade and it supports Banja Luka. It supports Dodik, the Serbian leader of the Autonomous Republic of Little Serbia inside of Bosnia. I say that and it kind of creates the wrong picture. Look at it on a map. It's actually, you know, the Serbian part of Bosnia, we're not talking about a little island or a little kind of thing inside of Bosnia. It's half of Bosnia is actually Serbia. And the Serbs of that part want to join up with regular Serbia. They want to have a referendum to leave Bosnia, and they want to join Serbia. Okay. Now think about the problem. Okay. The Muslims want to control the Serbians. They want to have the territory that the Serbians live on that is part of the UN country called Bosnia, right? And they don't want the Serbs to have a voice there about their direction and their lives and their future and the alliances and the commitments that, you know, the whole country has to get wrapped up in at the level of international affairs and energy deals. Because the veto right now is about energy. I think there's pipeline, there's a Hungary pipeline. I know there's another one, but effectively we're talking about Russian gas. It comes in. And the way that it was designed, the Serbian Republic, Autonomous Republic, has important controls on important valves of this energy. They're not only dependent on it, but they have certain keys to the system of energy that Sarajevo doesn't have. And Sarajevo also legally, under the present constitution, cannot overrule that or get the Serbian authority of Bosnia to go along with the Western sanctions or to turn the gas off. You see the problem? So even though we know this is an ongoing crisis since 2014, to continue to Balkanize the Balkans, okay, you'll see that the Serbian push is to un-Balkanize the Balkans, right? Where the term Balkanization comes from is actually, you know, the process of breaking up countries, as has happened in the West Balkans. And Serbia is trying to reconnect to Montenegro, reconnect to the Serbian Republic. It's actually called Republika Srpska, but we just say it just becomes too much to, you know, our terms. And would like to probably, I think, make a trade on Kosovo and have, you know, Metohija and enclaves and things like that. For now, but not lose their claim, historic constitutional claim, but really to kind of delay resolution, because by modern population issues, the crisis is that, you know, Albanians are trying to leave Albania at a faster rate than Serbians are trying to leave Serbia. And another thing that's happening is that because of the fact that Serbs do recognize everyone born in Kosovo as a Serbian citizen, despite the politics of the Kosovar Albanians, they love to get those Serbian passports that they're entitled to and then start buying houses in Serbia. So now you have actually the Kosovar Albanians around Niš. You have Sanjak. You have, and that's going to be a Bosnian claim even too. It's going to be a mess. So, you know, if like Serbia would have to not consider Kosovo to be an integral part of Serbia to deny those passports to stop the migration crisis, because Kosovo cannot exist, doesn't have the foundation to exist as an independent state, if not for these Frankenstein, you know, life support machines, artificial balkanization, and infusion of, you know, of debt-driven GDP stabilization from the Troika and transatlantic banks isn't sufficient. You can't just prop up these little micro regimes in the West Balkans. The general tendency is going to be to gravitate around, you know, the normal capital flows and relationships and cultural imperatives with Belgrade as the center of gravity. And Zagreb is an important, like you would almost say satellite or kind of in between, maybe, Vienna and Belgrade or something, or Prague and Belgrade, but you know, Tirana, all of these, Belgrade's really the city. So you need an artificial system to break up, you know, you would have some kind of iteration of Yugoslavia, and the problems, the narrative backfilling shit would solve itself in terms of like what the real story is, the relationship between Muslims and Orthodox or Catholics, and you know, World War II has to be kind of rehashed out and solved, and you know, Serbs have to recognize that not every Croat is an Ustasha, and Croats have to recognize that the language they're speaking is, you know, probably more like Serbian than whatever, you know, language that they believe they had when they existed as Croats but not Serbs prior to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, etc. You know what I mean? Like, how many fucking layers? Let's be real, people. Really, our lives kind of suck, and we don't feel like we can displace the people in power, but we can certainly throw rotten tomatoes at people on the other side of the fence. So that tends to be what happens, you know. If you can't punch up, you know, sometimes punching sideways can feel like punching up, as long as you're not punching down. But there's a lot of these issues with, you know, can be back solved. It really, just think about this. Think about what Russia's plan in Ukraine is, and how are they going to recreate the narrative and stuff like that? Like, how are they going to have people, you know, who are Ukrainian citizens and may have felt that they were Ukrainian? Certainly they may have been uncomfortable with the anti-Russian rhetoric, and they probably speak Russian, I don't feel British because I speak English. It doesn't, you know, that doesn't make me English because English is my native language. I feel American, and obviously geographic historical differences, but you get the idea. You can be very Ukrainian and know you speak Russian, and you probably realize that you're never going to join the EU, and you're probably going to realize that if you know something about what's happening, you're going to see that you're able to get Russian citizenship, there's stability over there, cheap energy, lots of land, timber, things like that, and you're kind of weighing things out. A lot of these people were forced into this position, but they may have felt very horrified by the Russian incursion initially, and people have lost loved ones in this conflict, you know, nieces and nephews, sons and daughters, Ukrainians dying in the Ukrainian army. So what is Russia's plan to heal all of that and to kind of still create a narrative that half of Ukraine, it's going to be some kind of pro-Russian country or some type of extension of Russia, and another part of Ukraine is going to be a neutral pro-Russian country out of Kiev? How are they going to have narratives about what happened? You see what I'm saying? So really it takes 10, 15, 20 years. That's what it's taken in the windup in Yugoslavia and post-Yugoslavia. Right, there was like a lot of kumbaya and like, you know, people, you know, happening prior to the Yugoslav wars. People also could see that there were tensions building for a long time, and a lot of the defects in the Yugoslav system that didn't actually allow for creating Yugoslav people. Basically, like everyone was treated as a former subject of the Serbs. And so everyone was given the like autonomous national culture rights within federal Yugoslavia, but the Serbs were treated, because like we said, Titoism and Marxism of Yugoslavia, despite being influenced by the Soviet model and kind of nominally being Leninist, actual Austro-Marxism is based in the Second International, the Western tradition of national chauvinism and anti-Slavism. And the Austro-Marxism is based in the view that there was a progressive historical character to the Austro-Hungarian monarchy and dynasty, and that the Serbs were effectively a type of Ottoman or outgrowth of the Ottomans or perpetuating, you know, colonial or imperial models derived from the Ottomans. And now the Serbs were a kind of regional hegemon that were suppressing or oppressing, you know, Croats and Slovenes, etc. Well, you know, that's actually a synonym for Serb, but to the extent that there's a people called Slovenians, etc. Yes, the Slovakian army is called the Army of Slovenes. And then you have Slovenia. And then the word Slovene is a, what's it called, synonym for Serb, historically. So there's lots of, and also so are Veneti, the Vendi, you know, the people who founded Verona and Venice and Serbia of Italy, where else? Yeah, that area there, where Brenner was, you know, you have the Etruscans and the Slavs, Slovenes, Wendi, Serbs, all going back in Italy, in fact, at a certain point in time, yeah? So all these people, you know, the border between Italy and the Slavic world of Yugoslav people there has shifted a lot. There's parts have been Italy. They've gone back, you know, so one day you wake up, you're Italian, your kids have to go to school. They're learning Italian, you know, they think they're Italians. And then some thing happens and somebody dies and the army moves over here. And now you're all, you know, Croatians or Slovenians. And now you're learning, you know, a Slavonic. Now your kids are learning that since the beginning of time, we've been this people. Yeah, that's how it goes. And, you know, fine if you have a national myth and you're secluded on a continent across an ocean, you can whatever manifest destiny yourself into any kind of self-realization trip you want to be on. But, you know, when you're in a kind of micro Europe and all these fucking states are piled on top of each other, these are the outcomes you're going to get. All these conflicting romanticisms and stuff. But by the normal evolution of things, in the same way that the natural gravity of Central Europe is to gravitate towards Russia, and in the same way that on a larger civilizational scale, Eurasia, the development of a Paris, Berlin, Moscow axis is a gravitational issue, a natural development. It has to be, you have to have a lot of foreign forces, transatlantic, et cetera, kind of working to artificially create these divisions in Eurasia, despite their economic energy codependence, despite that there's roads and rail and, you know, like everything grids connects it. You've got this ocean and you have this entity that has power. This cabal, this transatlantic cabal, spun out of the Third Reich, having power and the British Empire in this Oceania. And with Airstrip 1 being England, and they are the ones that are, you know, perpetuating this age-old divide-and-conquer tactic and perpetuating how to balance, you know, developments on the Eurasian continent. We go back, I'm going to say for the 20th time, E.H. Carr, writing over 100 years ago, one of the founders of, strangely, realism, despite many idealist, you know, kind of suppositions, E.H. Carr, Realism and International Relations, looked at precisely this question, development of the British Empire and British power on the European continent, favoring the French over the Germans until one got too powerful, and then favoring the Germans over the French, and going back and forth. or like how the U.S. played in the Iran-Iraq war, right? Giving weapons and intelligence to either side, and then, you know, let's you and him fight. So you have Iran-Iraq war. You have a lot of this happening. So the Balkans is not going to be different. Sarajevo is not sovereign. They're openly a, you know, they designed their flag to be a variation of a combination of some heraldry, but using the EU colors. There's some historic Bosnian heraldry with a blue and silver, blue and white, but the blue and yellow thing is, and their flag is basically saying, hey, we're an EU state, right? What's their currency? Well, we don't really have, it's the convertible mark, right? This is a relic of the war and the German imperial designs from the warp time, and basically the division of the situation. And Germany's influence in Bosnia, you can actually still discover that there's the Deutsche Mark still exists, and the Deutsche Mark still has a value, and that value is approximately, I mean, within a fraction of a fraction of a, you know, a penny, the convertible mark, the Bosnian convertible mark, still exists. So there's, you can actually track European capital flows, and you can actually track the strength of the German component of the, what Germany makes up of, kind of, or what's the German component of the total strength of what makes the euro, in the convertible mark that still exists in Bosnia. Bosnia being a subject state controlled by Brussels and Berlin. But its antagonistic policy, you know, so economically it's, right, European, but politically it's, which is kind of anti-Serb by itself, but then worse, politically, you have this Muslim Brotherhood MI6 operation, Anglo-American operation in Bosnia. You know, they've done a lot to change everything, even the military, the martial tradition. They've gone in a, like, it looks like kind of like the Egyptian army now, the Bosnian army. So Croats are not happy. Serbs are not happy. They're not happy with each other, but they can agree about not being happy about what Bosnia is doing. But it's going to have this awful consequence. So yeah, that's a wrap for today. That's actually what's happening. It's moving forward, as we said, the crisis. If people think that this is just like stage show, Vucic doing stage show, there's a certain, you have in the U.S. Trump derangement syndrome. You have in Serbia Vucic derangement syndrome. It's a plan working perfectly according to plan, which is to have all the radical nationalists of Serbia hate Vucic for being too close to Europe or too close to the U.S., which then Vucic shows, guys, I can't move close. They hate me already, you know, and it kind of makes him look like he doesn't represent an extremist view. I mean, in reality, the Serbian nationalists are just sovereigntists of their country. They're, the temperature of what they're saying aside, the meaning of it is not really radical or that contentious is the issue. So they might even put things in trappings that seem more radical than they really are. The 99% of the people of, you know, of the Serbian Republic want to rejoin Serbia. You can call that Serbian irredentism, but there's no indigenous population there in the Serbian part of Bosnia that would oppose that. Whereas in Kosovo, you really have a large, predominantly Kosovar, whatever that is, Albanian descended population. Serbia, like what, to like send in the army and like try to overrule their claim for independence is ugly. It's bad optics, it's bad meaning. It kind of breaks certain rules about how things are working right now. Serbia should not let it go from its constitution, but it can't seek, you know, an outcome based upon how things work right now. But it can seek an outcome on Bosnia. that's what the cabal is terrified about. They know that that outcome, you know, if you look at a map, this augments Serbia's territory by, I don't know, like almost double or just under double. It population, I think it adds 3 million to 8 million. And things like this. We talk about the energy and the pipeline stuff is important. It's critical. And all the incentives and the ability. So you have, you look at like, what's the ability, what's the incentive, what's the motive, right? Like what's the, can you do it? Will you do it? And the cabal right now is holding all the pieces to pull off this, a political stunt in Sarajevo. And that's going to happen any day now. It can happen in a week, and it can happen in 2 months. But this is something that is unfolding and keeps. I'm not trying to come back to the subject because I'm in Serbia. This is like the big thing popped off yesterday with Kosovo again, and then 2 days ago, actually, it was actually pretty big news about Croatia. They just kind of got swept under the rug, but Croatia is also saying we're not fine with the Muslim part of the Muslim Croat Federation flexing and basically eliminating the Croatian rights. This is a junta, a Muslim Brotherhood junta, to impose also Sharia law and over Catholics in Europe. I mean, it's right. I mean, this is not the same thing as a no-go zone in France, but it's just very bizarre. The history is very bizarre. It's a very interesting location where you have, you know, for 500 years, indigenous Muslims, you know, right across the, you know, talk about like Sarah Palin. I could see Alaska from, I can see Russia from my front door. Yeah, you can see Italy from, you know, the shore of Bosnia. And it's a Muslim entity that the Russians don't consider have ability to survive on its own. Don't have ability to survive or create a stable state around it. Also, it's not just, surviving on its own is the ability for foreign powers to keep, you know, pumping money into it to keep it alive, kind of like Ukraine right now. And in a slow motion way, that's how a lot of these little, like Estonia and Latvia and Lithuania, like they can't make it on their own, guys. Like, you could argue that what you see is basically being absorbed by Brussels, but Brussels doesn't operate even in European interests entirely, is the problem as well, in terms of sovereignty and nature of transatlantic power in the EU. So countries, like we're living in a system that has a UN and has countries, almost 200 of them, and they're all supposed to be equal in terms of international law. But in reality, you have spheres of influence. And spheres of influence, we talked about in March, and we're going to have to return to it probably again, is not international law, okay? And it's not in the rules-based system, okay? This predates that. This predates both of those concepts and is more organic and historically driven, and it's based in realism. Even though, of course, there's realist approaches to international law, and you need them realistically, and that's why we have them, you know, they're not, international law is not an idealist imposition on realism or something like that. That would be a big error to make, okay? But you have that thinking out there, but it would be an error to make that. But besides international law, you have the transatlanticists trying to break away from international law and impose a unilateral, you know, rules-based system globally, okay? It's true that there are problems in international law in terms of how we look at the question of spheres of influence, because spheres of influence is not really contemplated at the level of primacy where you would even promote the sovereignty of a microstate that doesn't have organic foundation for sovereignty. You would put that as prime over contemplations, you know, realistic contemplations of spheres of influence. And that can lead to a crisis. Let me give an example. Taiwan is within China's sphere of influence. Look at it on the map, see where it is, and see who would be against it and how far they'd have to project their power to untangle that. And who would be outside of their historic sphere of influence and who would be within their sphere of influence, right? So, you know, if California decided that it was going to take Baja California, you know, it would be crazy for China to intervene on that. And it would be prudent for, it would be expected that Mexico would protest, but it would be crazy for China to intervene. You see the difference? So Taiwan can protest, but it's in the Chinese sphere of influence. And it's also, we're being fed a simulation about Taiwan and China anyway. People in Taiwan are divided about this, of course, but I've met tons of Taiwanese that are very proud of China and consider themselves to be Chinese. And these are not communists. These are like bar owners in Los Angeles that would, in prior decades, call themselves Taiwanese and now call themselves Chinese. Not because people confuse them of being from Thailand, no. But just because they're proud to say they're Chinese. And Beijing really has soft power in Taiwan. Like people in Taiwan who want to get into business and corporate sphere, they're not looking to Western countries to move to as the future and where the all the action is at, or the glamour, or the romance, or the intrigue, or whatever, the opportunities. None of that is people. Taiwanese look to mainland China. To Isle of Formosa, and the government there, and like the Taiwan is made up of Chinese people. Like there was like some island indigenous people and stuff, different complexion, different features, but the Chinese ethnicities like dominate. It's just the breakaway government that failed, and it would have been, by the way, you know. The Kuomintang would have had to do the same things as the CCP did, by the way, in terms of unifying the country and stomping out the warlords, removing the Japanese from it. I mean, they actually said they had the same goals. They were explicitly so. It would have been a nationalist government, probably one party regime, and it would have been almost identical to what you see today. The flag would be a different color. It would be maybe blue instead of red, and it would be the blue army instead of the red army, whatever, you know what I mean? But it'd be the same shit if it was going to succeed. But what would not have succeeded for China is to be, you know, Manchuria controlled by the Japanese, and then like five different ports controlled by the English, and then, you know, everyone else on opium. That wasn't going to work. So there's a lot of realism is very useful, because actually a lot of Americans are actually idealists about foreign policy. They don't realize they're realists about their own like money and bank accounts and business decisions, and they're very realist. But then when they think about the world, suddenly everyone is fucking Gandhi. And it's just not that way. I think Arestovich was pointing out that it's actually dumb that Ukrainians think that people of other countries legitimately believe that their country should sacrifice anything for Ukraine. Like, actually, that's a dumb belief. It is a dumb belief. It's a dumb belief to expect. It comes from a tremendous place of privilege and thinking everything is okay in your country, to think that you can break an already broken bank, you know, on some foreign adventure that's destined to lose. But the Germans, you know, speaking, just kind of getting back to Serbia here, the Germans' only way forward is to negotiate a deal with Russia for German industrialists, and then the energy stuff, and then the production in Serbia. So there's definitely a lot of space for German-Russian collaboration, joint projects, using Serbia as this kind of frontier of this kind of netherworld, and you know, that's neither east nor west. That's been Belgrade's winning solution for the best part of the last century. All right. I think that's been a pretty good description of the situation. As always, I've been Joaquin with you. I'll see you around another day or two. All right. Peace. I'm out.